Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guest today is Neil Lee. Neil is Professor of Economic Geography at the London School of Economics. Neil writes about a great variety of different issues, publishing lots of articles and papers. And he's mainly focused on issues around cities and innovation and inequality. And his latest paper, co-authored with Andreas Rodriguez-Pose, is Hipsters versus Geeks, Creative Workers, STEM and Innovation in US Cities. And that's the subject of today's episode, which for those listening, just to let you know that we are recording this in late April 2020. So Neil, welcome back to City Talks.
Thank you for having me.
So I suppose the first and most important question is, are you a hipster or are you a geek?
I'm a geek, sadly. Tragic. I don't think there's a single one of my friends who would call me a hipster.
Does that mean Andreas is the hipster?
Andreas is definitely the hipster in this paper. He's like
he's got the beard, isn't he?
He's got a beard and nice glasses, whereas I'm the geek.
I was thinking about that. I don't think I'm either. I conclude that I must be an anorak.
No, I think you're very clearly a hipster.
Having got that most important question out of the way, the paper, I think, we'll talk through the paper, what you did and the context for it. And it's very much centered around, human capital, which everybody, or practically everybody, agrees is really important for economic growth and innovation. But as you rightly say, and you kind of the way you set it up, there are sort of debates going on around, what type of human capital and which, does some human capital matter more than most, which kind of situates the paper in that wider literature and the wider context. So just give us your reflection on, on that literature and put the study in the context of the ongoing debate in economic geography and urban economics.
So, the paper builds on a sort of what I guess is a really long-standing debate in the social sciences more generally, right? Going back to a guy called C.P. Snow when he wrote about two cultures of science and arts. And historically, we tended to see the sort of arts and the creative industries as being sort of somehow distinct from the sort of scientific, the sort of innovative process, or sort of doing very different things. And basically, more recently, in the last 15 or 20 years or so, we've started that sort of distinction has broken down. So whereas we used to always see, innovation as purely being about science, now we increasingly see it as being about the sort of meshing, sort of the fusion, the interrelationships between science and the arts. So Steve Jobs, we all know who he is from Apple. He talked about Apple's success as being partly because they were at the intersection of technology and the liberal arts. Because basically it wasn't good enough to just have a new product which was technologically advanced, but you also had to market it, design it, make it nice. And basically this, so this is something which we see in some of the sort of leading firms of the digital economy. And what we do in this paper is we look at, and there's been studies, so I've worked on studies where we try and show this relationship at a firm level. But what we do in this study is we try and look at cities. Because cities are, one of the big economic, social advantages of cities is that they facilitate mixing between people with different ideas, from different backgrounds, with different skill sets. So we look to see what happens at a city level and whether we can see the relationship between science and creative occupations and innovation. And look, we shouldn't be overstating our findings. Science matters most. Science is really, really important. But the thing we see is that the most successful places, the most innovative cities, they're the places which have a combination of the two, a combination of science and artistic skills or creative occupations. Those are the places which are really driving the sort of innovation system of the US.
And just say a little bit, the sort of the leading proponents and thinking within those kind of two schools, as you note in the paper, I think that, the STEM science sort of contribution to innovation is longer standing. There's a kind of bigger literature to that in some respects, whereas the creative contribution is more recent and there are certain, relatively high profile proponents of that sort of idea. So just unpack that a little bit, just say a little bit more about those, those relevant literatures and, are they,
The other piece in the paper, I think, which is really interesting, was, you know, you're looking at the literature as it relates to firms and noting that, as well as then thinking about how does that migrate into looking at the urban scale or the city scale as well. So just unpack that a bit for us a little bit.
Yeah, so over the longer term, we have always thought that, you know, science has always been seen rightly as highly important for innovation. We know this is the basis of most research in this area. So people like Marianne Feldman looking at sort of science, you know, science basis. We know, and we've always known this, and, you know, just this is correct, right? You know, we know that, and this leads to policy prescriptions around sort of science parks and the fact you should invest in R&D. And these are all correct, you know, good things to do at a sort of very general level. But more recently, about sort of, well, it must be 20 years ago now, creative occupations and creative industries became increasingly seen as important. And one of the leading proponents of that was a guy called Richard Florida, who I know you've had in this podcast series a couple of times. And Richard, who's a sort of enormously impressive communicator and a very, you know, I think a very decent guy, he came up with this very controversial theory about the creative class. And by the creative class, he basically talked about the idea that there was, you know, this class of people with distinct values, with distinct sort of locational preferences, who were driving the economy. And this led people to start thinking much more about creativity and the role of creativity in urban economies. Now, there's a catch here, right? Which is that if you read Richard's books, you know, when he talks about the creative class, he's not explicitly talking about people working in creative industries, creative occupations. And in some of his work, he'd include scientists as being about that sort of creative class, you know, because he knows that, you know, he was much more focused on the sort of general notion of creativity, I guess, and people who use creativity to solve problems and produce a sort of economic return on the basis of that. But this was sort of, but this research was basically very, you know, it was highly controversial. People didn't like the theory. Of course, academics also don't like, sometimes don't like other academics who are sort of successful and are, you know, in a sort of global state. You know, it's true, right? But also because, you know, there were sort of reasonable, you know, academic, theoretical, and certainly empirical grounds for sort of for complaining about Richard's work. But, you know, it's been enormously influential, and it's led to a lot of thinking about the creative industries and a lot of sort of policy area there, a lot of policy effort there, a lot of which has been sort of fairly muddy. Now, in the UK, we've also had this sort of wider sort of creative industries agenda. So our economy has, you know, has been growing or has been shifting structurally into sectors related to creativity. So you have to be kind of careful here, because there's a lot of sort of, like I say, sort of fuzzy, sort of muddy thinking here. You have to be kind of careful when you think about the creative industries, because we, on one hand, we think about the creative industries as being about, you know, you might think about being design or the arts, and that's part of it. But also, most definitions of the creative industries, they include stuff which we would see as being part of the tech sector, which is driven by science anyway. So part of what we're trying to do in this paper is sort of try and strip, you know, so we're almost saying that actually this distinction is, in some senses, a little bit unhelpful, right? Yeah. Because, you know, it's often the two together which are hugely important.
Yeah, and we'll come on to that, because I think the point, a very particular and very interesting point, you both you refer to and then look at in the empirical sense in the paper, is around not just the presence of either STEM workers or creative workers, however defined, and we'll come on to that, but actually that tells us something about what we think urban success or urban innovation might look like. But actually it's the interaction between those two that really matters, which we'll come back on to in a minute. But just in terms of the human capital sort of space, Neil, I mean, I one of the other reflections I have, you know, or you see in the debate, is what do we mean by human capital? And on the one hand, you know, there's a kind of occupational sort of analysis, you know, what people are actually doing or the jobs that they're doing, versus actually it's about qualifications. And we, you know, that's the way to kind of understand. And that really tells us much more about, you know, urban success, however we want to define. Just, I mean, what your thoughts and reflections on that sort of debate? Because that's, that was one of the critiques of Richard's original work, right? I mean, Ed Glaser was one of those kind of critics really said, look, you know, you're looking at the wrong kind of thing. If you really need to think about human capital, you're right, but it's qualifications we should really think about and focus on.
Yeah, so I mean, qualifications, so this sort of human capital perspective is, I mean, it's a subject of a whole massive literature. And I guess, so my view is that it's not so much about, so qualifications can mask, you know, credentialism. They can be, you know, you can have people who go to the best universities in the world and, you know, won't use the skills or, you know, won't actually develop sort of any capital on the basis of that, apart from a sort of symbolic capital. But really, so really what we're arguing in this paper is that it's kind of what you do which matters. And the best way of measuring this we have is occupations. And it's not a perfect way of measuring it. But actually, the sort of, you know, it matters to me more if someone is a, you know, it matters more if someone is working in a sort of design job than if someone just has a sort of pure design degree. And in part, that's because you can only sort of sustain a, you can only sustain employment in a particular occupation for a very long period of time if you, if there is sufficient demand for it. And one of the things we know from the literature on human capital is that, yeah, you can develop all the human capital you want, but if there's no demand for it, it's a pretty useless sort of exercise. So what we're arguing in this paper is actually, and this is something we've researched over almost a decade actually now, is the role of, you know, we tend to focus on industries, we tend to focus on the creative industries, but in this paper, we're much more interested in the occupations people do. And I, you know, I don't care if someone is a designer in a fintech firm or a designer in a sort of, in their own sort of design agency. What I should be caring about economically is what they're doing and what they're doing is, for the economy. And that's why focusing at a city level and focusing at a sort of occupational level, we think is a good way of looking at this.
Just to round off the sort of your reflections on the literature, say your reflections on the literature as it relates to sort of firm level performance and firm level activity and how then that sort of migrates up to the urban scale. Just give us a sense as to that, because obviously there's quite a lot of literature again on, you know, firm level performance being driven by, you know, human capital in various ways, which then, you know, more innovative firms have more diverse sometimes. I mean, that's your previous work as well, more diverse management and or workforces. But just say something about the relationship between a firm and the city in the literature.
Yeah, so, I mean, so going right back to sort of Jane Jacobs and the idea of Jane. So Jane Jacobs, very famous sort of, you know, I think she's a journalist, but she sort of has crossed over into urban planning and economics and all sorts of stuff like that. And she suggested the idea of Jacobs externalities, the idea that one of the main benefits of cities is that you bump into and you can sort of engage closely with people who are sort of different to you on a sort of day-to-day basis. Well, the second thing about cities, which I think is really important, is, you know, for me, the most important economic asset of cities, or my reading of the evidence, coming from people like Reinhard Erikson in Uppsala, is that they provide the economic benefits of thick labor markets. You know, our paper, we sort of argue that cities are vital because they provide labor markets and they provide spillovers between different people doing these different specialist occupations. And that translates into economic success. So, you know, classic example is, you know, I have friends who work in design and they specialize in designing crazy stuff to do with fintech. And you can, you know, they're designers. They produce beautiful work, but they can manage to be designers like that in a city like London because there is the sort of depth of specialist work for them to do, so they can sort of sustain these occupations. So I don't know if I really answered your question, but basically it's this sort of...
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, because it touches on the sort of structure of the economy, you know, and in the examples that you've given, you know, some of the way that the spillovers and the exchanges are happening are through fairly fluid labour markets where people are either moving from job to job or they're moving from task to task and they're taking knowledge with them that's gained. And so, you know, I think people often don't feel, you know, fully, you know, have a grip on the transmission mechanisms through which spillovers occur and or how knowledge is exchanged. They think it's kind of firm to firm on a kind of collaboration basis, which is true, but actually it's often individuals moving from firms to firms. So
exactly, it's individuals, and that's particularly the case we think with you know, some of these creative occupations where people tend to work on a task by task basis or will tend to work for a sort of small agency, which then, you know, essentially transfers knowledge across other companies. Because that's what a lot of this is about. It's about how you know, cities facilitate that sort of, you know, those transmission mechanisms. That's why they're sort of more productive.
Yeah. Okay. So you've talked about it and given some of the insights, but let's just talk through the paper and the way that you've done it. So just say a little bit about the approach that, and crudely, I mean, you didn't say it like this, but, you know, the hypothesis is that it's interaction as much as, or if not more important than presence alone for innovation. So just in thinking about it like that, just say a little bit about, because you've talked about it already, how we should broadly be thinking about creative, STEM, innovation, and then city. Let's get our kind of units of analysis sort of broadly out, and then we can get into what you did and the results that you found.
So we're looking at US cities. So we have 290 US cities over a period of about, I think it's about 11 years, 10 or 11 years. So a decent sort of data set. And then we're hiving off two sets of occupations. So one set, and these are based on the sort of standard, actually, the UK government definitions of creative occupations. So this includes some people who are like designers, some people who are sort of artists, some people who are, I mean, there's some random ones in there as well, right? Urban planners and things like that. But these are occupations which are generally seen as being reliant on sort of creativity. And then we have this second set of occupations, and the second set of occupations, they are basically, they are occupations which are likely to have people working in them who have STEM degrees. So science, technology, engineering, and maths. And so this is people who work in sort of as scientists, R&D scientists, computer engineers, stuff like that. And we show quite clearly that the most innovative cities, you know, we show quite clearly that first of all, that the most innovative cities there is a positive relationship between people working in science, technology, science-based occupations and innovation, but then that relationship is sort of accelerated when they are also working in co-presence with people who are in the creative occupations. And we don't show this is causal, but we have good causal evidence from other studies at the firm level, which leads us to suggest that it's probably, you know, it's definitely a sort of relationship which is worth investigating. I should say that for sort of urban economists, economic geographers, we talk about causal as being, you know, can we definitely say that A led to B? And we can't do that because there might be a sort of feedback loop where people who work in successful technology companies can afford to hire nice designers for their gardens or something like that. So yeah, we can't definitely say that, but we can be pretty confident that what's going on is causal.
And am I right in thinking that, or reading the paper, that roughly if you take those two sort of groups, creative and STEM, together, that's about 3% of the workforce, I think, in the paper. And you say that, you know, that's it's growing. Is that right?
So these are growing shares of the US workforce.
Yeah.
And they're growing shares, particularly in some cities. So we don't publish this, but, you know, you can see that there is other work suggesting that some of these industries are starting to cluster in relatively fewer number of metros. And we don't present that in the paper, but there's other work which suggests that.
And in the paper, which you're completely open about, we have exactly the same issue at the centre of the cities. Your measure for innovation is patenting. That's right. And you talk a lot about, you know, the limitations of it, but also, you know, the merits of it. So just say something like that, you know, about that.
Yeah. So our measure for this is patenting, although we now have data for trademarks. So we're going to look at that as well, which is another sort of measure of innovation. But in our defense, there is also, this is the patenting one, where there are other studies which we have done where we look at other measures of innovation. So this is funded by the AHRC, Policy and Evidence Center for the Creative Industries. And one of the guys who works on that, a guy called Josh Seipel, has written a paper where he looks at firm level data, and he shows that similar relationships at the firm level, where they have different indicators of innovation, he shows that there's, you know, where you have firms who employ people who have arts degrees and science degrees, they are more likely, I mean, statistically significantly more likely to produce radical innovations. So, you know, see, this is part of the evidence base rather than everything.
Yeah. My other question on that, just your reflection on it, Neil, is obviously you're looking at US cities. Was that a did you have a was that a particular decision, or was that simply because what we also know is that in many respects, data at the kind of, you know, metro or subnational scale can often be better in the US and elsewhere than it is maybe in the UK. But was there something particular that drove you towards the US, or just that that's where you wanted to look at?
So I guess there's sort of contextual and practical reasons, right? So contextual, we know that the US is, you know, one of the frontier economies, right? And so we know, and we also know that a lot of the sort of, I guess, flagship firms for this sort of area of research, so like Apple, come out of the US. So we thought the US was particularly interesting. There's also practical reasons, right? Which is that it's very difficult to get UK data now. So, you know, some people like yourselves make data available, which is great, but actually sometimes it can be quite hard to get hold of access to the labor force survey. And it just means that for researchers like me, it's just simpler to go to the US where you get a bigger sample size, and you can just download the data and work with it rather than having to fill in lots of forms.
A recurring theme on these podcasts, which is about the need for better data across the board in terms of subnational economies, is just a constant request by, you know, the vast majority of those that, you know, think about and work in the UK context. Someday, I hope we will, you know, we'll come on here and say the data is absolutely amazing and fantastic. But I think we've got a ways to go yet, despite the very good improvements that the ONS are actively trying to bring about. It's a very good point. Okay, so let's go to the results. So for our listeners, Neil, can you just sort of unpack, you know, what are the types of cities types of metro areas that have lots of these two types of groups? You know, are they the obvious classics that people will already have in their mind? New York, San Francisco, probably Los Angeles. Are they in it? But also, you know, what other places are in it as well?
Yeah, so it'll be places like, so San Jose comes out in our data, you know, very high, San Francisco. Because of the sort of boundaries we have, we're sort of, you know, separating those two places out. Yeah, New York, but then there's a few sort of smaller metros, which are often sort of places where there is a sort of strong research university, which sort of come into our data as well. So some of the ones, the sort of Raleigh, Durham, I think is in there, places like that. But it's a familiar pattern of sort of US.
And places like Ithaca seem to be kind of prominent, which is upstate New York, if my geography is...
It has, because of Cornell. Yeah, so places like that. And we control in some of the, I can't remember if we made it into the final paper, we control for sort of presence of universities and do various things like that. But yeah, and you can see it's the classic tech hubs, basically.
And so the argument, well, the paper says, you know, metro areas that more of these two groups have higher rates of innovation. Is that right? In a kind of very boiled down sort of sense.
Yeah, and you can see that. So we have a sort of nice, you know, I always think you should show your descriptive statistics, and we have a nice little graph where we just show, you know, size of bubble is how many patents there are per capita, and you can just see that the big patenting areas are the places which include both of these.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's the presence question. So talk a little bit now about how you get at the interaction question, or the interaction issue.
Andrews did that. It was so the interaction, it's a simple interaction. We run some sort of interaction plots. I mean, so the paper is freely available online. So there's, you know, there's, and basically what we can show is, so we run some basic regressions where we show, you know, we show these sort of positive relationships, and then we interact. And the interesting thing is, once we interact, the, you know, what we're calling them, our sort of hipster variable and our geek variable, we find that actually, you know, the effect of creative occupations doesn't matter, or in fact sometimes is negative, whereas the effect of geeks sort of, you know, it doesn't sort of exist anymore, basically. So what it is that it's only where you have both of these two things in their sort of co-presence, that's when you end up with the sort of impact on innovation. So that's what we find, and we can show this. You know, it's not the clearest relationship. It's a nice sort of statistical relationship. We can show that basically where you have more creative occupations, the impact of STEM occupations on innovation is higher. So if you have like a sort of a city with much more in the way of sort of creative occupations take. You know, so I think one of the cities which comes highest out of our, in terms of sort of creative occupations, would be somewhere like Santa Fe in New Mexico, where you have, you know, with a lot of hipsters. That's not necessarily particularly sort of innovative, but in a place where, such as San Jose, where you have both the combination of the hipsters and the geeks, that's the type of place where you really end up with the sort of the innovation payoff.
Yeah, I thought that was, you know, the sense, it's kind of interesting one around, you know, as you say, it's thinking about the interaction between, and that goes back to your opening observations about how some of these markets or firms that they're maturing and actually becoming, they're becoming a blend of marketing, comms, and, you know, and very kind of science and technology sort of driven entities as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the sort of, and we know this from the UK as well, right? So there was an influential study by Paul Nightingale and Jonathan Sapstead, you know, quite a long time ago now, where they looked at the Brighton digital cluster. And they basically showed that in Brighton, they've got loads of sort of these digital technology firms. And they basically said that amongst them, the ones where they integrated, not just, they didn't just have the technical skills, but they had the sort of art skills as well. Those are the ones which were sort of growing faster and really sort of dominating the cluster. So the type of, you know, so you can see these processes at play in the UK as well, although we don't have sort of hard econometric evidence for it yet.
What was interesting in the paper as well, which I really liked, was that you talked a little bit about some of the controls that you used in order to get at, the interaction, and explained a bit of the literature behind essentially why you'd use those kind of variables as well. And so you make the observation that when we actually control for variables around income and size, for example, it seems that income is more important than size, which is again a kind of ongoing conversation in the UK, which is actually, it seems to be that our bigger cities, particularly outside of London and probably Bristol, you know, their size is not a significant contributor to economic performance, and actually mid-sized richer places in the southeast tend to do typically better. But just say a little bit about that find, or that your reflections on that.
Yeah, so I mean, I would always say that somewhere like Bristol or, you know, Oxford, where I'm from, it doesn't have size, but it definitely has sort of proximity to economic mass. And I think in the UK context, that's more important. So, you know, so a lot of these sort of city size studies, they look at city size in the context of the United States, where cities are often, not always, but often a bit more sort of spread out. In the UK, what matters much more is, you know, basically how close you are to London, how close you are to sort of mega city one. So anyway, in our study, We basically there's some econometric issues with including income, but we test to see whether income is sort of driving things, and it matters, and it matters actually more than, you know, like you say, more than size, and that's because there are lots of these smaller metros, you know, like I just said, the sort of Raleigh, North Carolina, which manage to do well on both of these measures. And also we're not looking at the places where there is the highest total number of patenting. We're looking at patents per capita. So.
Yeah. And you also, again, touches on your previous work. You also trying to get at some sort of sense as to what whether diversity is a kind of variable. And I think you use men in the workforce. Is that a percentage of men in the workforce? Is that right in terms of trying to get a grip on the or at least to give some nod to the diversity question?
Yeah. So actually, men in the workforce, we partly included that because there's sort of some of the towns we were looking at were, you know, some of the cities in there had sort of quite interesting shares of men in the workforce. And we think it was because we were capturing either army bases or mining towns. So we were putting it in there to account for that rather than anything more than that. But one thing which is clear, right, is that we know, and there's loads of very strong evidence that diversity matters. And actually, so by diversity, we mean diversity in terms of cultural diversity. So where, you know, your sort of your personal background, diversity of country of birth. So, you know, where you were born and brought up. And there's a sort of whole separate literature which suggests that this sort of meshing of people from different cultures, from different backgrounds, can lead to innovation because it leads to new ideas and so on. And I guess we'd see our study as being a sort of contributing to that in some sense, and that we're borrowing some of the same sort of theoretical ideas. You know, once you have people who are Yeah, this goes back to, as I was saying, the sort of earlier study, the sort of, you know, 1950s debates about two cultures of science and arts in the UK. The idea is that if you have two groups of people who can talk to one another and can sort of listen to the sort of insights which are coming from two separate fields, then you're likely to end up with more innovations and more, I guess, cross-pollination of ideas than you would do in other contexts.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great, and that perfectly kind of leads on to, you know, you not in lots of detail, but you in your sort of conclusions or reflections, you know, you raise a couple of observations which obviously have implications for policy, and I just want to get you your kind of thoughts on that. The obvious one, in a sense, is because we are very crudely looking at the kind of arts activity or creative occupations as well as science, there's an obvious immediate implication for policy, particularly in the economic field, which often seems to kind of swing backwards and forwards between those two things. You know, the industrial strategy, you know, very good, but very sort of science and tech orientated, you know, in terms of not really having much to say about the arts. But let's just say something about that, your reflections on, you know, if we keep these things artificially separate, it would seem to me that policy at the starting point is likely to be less effective.
Yeah, so absolutely. So, you know, that this artificial distinction, you know, this distinction between hipsters and geeks, we set it up as sort of like a straw man. And it's partly a straw man, but it does reflect the way that some people think about the world. You know, you have R&D scientists who do, you know, important science-based work, which leads to innovation. And then you have other people who are just sort of, you know, either living off of proceeds or sort of somehow, you know, having a very minor part in it. And we kind of feel like that way of looking at the world probably has sort of broken down a little bit. And then you have this other sort of point of view, which is that, you know, creativity is everything. And you have this other very strong lobby, I guess, on the creative industries, which says that, yeah, you need a creative quarter in every town and all that sort of stuff. And I don't think our evidence supports either view, because what we're looking at here is creative occupations where there is essentially demand for them, and creative industry and science being also important. So we're saying both of them matter to a certain degree. Now, the few things which we would probably say is, first of all, you know, I think our research shows that we should be thinking a lot more about occupations, and a lot more about the sort of, you know, so as a first point. The second point I'd say is we should also be thinking a bit about co-presence. So, you know, one of the traditional ways you might try and create innovation in a place is you would create a sort of science park. So places say, right, we look at Cambridge in the 1990s, they created a science park, it filled up, isn't that great? And, you know, sometimes that can be an appropriate policy, but actually often having science facilities in the middle of a city can be quite beneficial. So the Crick Institute in London is a really good example of it. You come out of King's Cross, there's loads of sort of nice arts and design stuff going on around there, and there is also a big leading edge sort of science-based, you know, science research institute. And I think that's a much better way of doing things, because you sort of, you know, you can hopefully gain something from these sort of interrelationships and the sort of, you know, co-presence of these two forms of economic activity.
And so just following on that, because that's an interest. So because you are saying, or that interaction matters as well as, or, you know, on top of presence. So having these, you know, having these workers in your place matters, but actually, you know, the interaction between them in various ways, which we've talked about, matters more. What's your thinking then around, you know, when we think about the urban policy, and actually this probably connects to the work that Max Nathan's been doing, you know, where, you know, you're looking at the city scale, he looked at the tech city, which is a kind of neighborhood within London's scale, talked about networks, you know, co-working environments, you know, the kind of informal interaction support side. Does your work suggest into those sort of areas as well, Neil?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's these, you know, so tech city is a really nice example of some of this sort of stuff, right? It's a, you know, a place which has, you know, strong art. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Hoxton was, you know, known for White Cube, the art gallery and the sort of art stuff which happened around there, rather than being known for sort of high tech startups as it is now. I think we're telling a very similar story about these sort of, you know, these relationships. And people like Google appreciate that. You know, the Google have got a, you know, Google campus in Shoreditch or nearby. You know, it's partly there because they can afford the high prices around there. But it's also there because they know that these sort of interrelationships matter quite a lot. You know, we talk about web design. Web design is about, you know, it's about technology and design. And, you know, that's something which didn't exist sort of 30 years ago or maybe 40 years ago. And it's the type of activity which has been really growing and the type of activity which we really need to be sort of thinking about as part of the models of the way the economy works.
We are having this conversation in the middle of a pandemic, where essentially the number one message that we receive is to stay at home and to socially distance if you do leave. And we've had a conversation about the importance of urban areas as kind of drivers of innovation and economic growth more generally, not only in the UK, but across the OECD and elsewhere. Secondly, that when we think about innovation, it's interaction, very, very close, proximate interaction that matters. Face-to-face is incredibly important. What does the implications of the pandemic have for those two observations? I mean, where are you on this? I'm not expecting a definitive answer, but, you know, you're a leading thinker on all issues related to urban economies and innovation and face-to-face. So, you know, I take this opportunity to get your thoughts on how you think the pandemic is going to play out and where, you know, whether we might see locational decisions of workers and or firms change as a result of the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is it's kind of an invitation to be wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, but we'll all be wrong in different ways, right? I mean, so
I mean, I guess I would think about three things happening now, right? One is the pandemic and the specific impact of the pandemic, which is, and the policy measures around it, so social distancing. So that's the first thing I'd say. Second thing is there's going to be a big cyclical change in the economy. So people aren't going to spend so much, people can lose their jobs, there will be a sort of drop in demand. And the third thing is that there is structural change happening in the economy anyway, towards things like sort of self-employment. And the, you know, my general feeling is that the sort of normally any sort of recession, these sort of second and third features, the cyclical drop in demand and the structure, you know, tends to lead to a speeding up of the structural change, which we're seeing anyway. So shifting the sort of the nature of work. This one's been rather more radical. So I think there's going to be a few things around, you know, one of the things I think we're noticing is that there are some things which we are really good at, not being in an office, and there are some things which we're really bad at. So, you know, if I teach lectures online and, you know, I'm terrible. I have no, you know, my poor students. So, you know, they have to watch me in my loft, you know, talking about lecture slides, whereas I think I'm much better sort of face-to-face. So there's some stuff which I think we will try and go back to, there'll be sort of big, powerful forces going back to. But there's some stuff which I think we're going to, I think it will change the way we use cities rather than sort of abolishing cities entirely. So now, you know, I know more of my neighbours now than I did before, which is, you know, a weird paradoxical thing. I'm much more sort of, you know, part of my local neighbourhood. I use delivery services much more than I used to, so it's certainly going to change the high street. And, you know, whatever, you know, we really need some new models for the high street to sort of work out what's going to happen there. But I have a strong suspicion that we will be going back to those expensive skyscrapers and those expensive central business districts in the long term. And it might be that we are using those offices less, but I still think, you know, my lesson from sort of, was it 5 weeks of this? I can't even tell you how long we've been doing it. Yeah. Actually, face-to-face contact still matters quite a lot, and it's still quite an efficient way of getting things done.
Yeah, no, I you know, again, as you say, you know, these are invitations to be wrong. I think you're right. I think the remote working impact, I think, you know, will be at the margins rather than a fundamental reform. And as you say, you know, I was saying this somewhere else, if you look at actually home working at the minute, our top cities, places like Brighton or Cambridge, I think Reading, the top end of working from home is about 10 to 12% of the working population. Now, I think that's probably going to increase because of this situation, but it's not going to increase to 50% or 60%. It's going to increase probably, even if it doubles, which would be, I think, a significant increase, it's still only doubling to, you know, one in five. If you go to places like Hull or Birkenhead, you know, these kind of places, working from home is less than 5%. And, you know, their economies are just organized differently, structured differently, that, as we know, again, working from home, the upper bound of that is going to be, you know, is going to be significantly lower.
Yeah, I think it's also going to have different implications for the sort of what you might call the high skilled labor market to the low skilled labor market. I shouldn't use the term low skilled. The low wage labor market, where you're thinking about people who are doing jobs which were at one, you know, probably vulnerable to automation. And I think there's going to be a lot more sort of structural change in that type of jobs. Everything from, you know, some of this stuff around delivery, you know, delivery has been a structural change, which has been sort of increasing. Now I can't see that, you know, I think we're sort of embedding that in people's sort of habits. And then there's also a lot of other stuff around the changing nature of the employment relationship. And this is one thing which I think is going to be interesting, right? So we used to, you can see this over the last sort of, you know, 70, 100 years. It used to be lots of people in a single office, or a single factory, whatever it was, they were able to unionize and they were able to see each other and they knew who each other were. Now we're suddenly seeing a situation where lots of those people are working from home, they're on their own, they might have some forms of surveillance, but it's sort of digital surveillance rather than sort of the pressure. And it's much harder for them to do things like form unions. And, you know, frankly, they just look less human to the sort of management who don't need to be sort of quite so much there. So one of the interesting things is going to be, are companies going to use this to sort of take tasks which were previously done in a particular place and essentially outsource the tasks to digital workers elsewhere? And that could have some sort of profound implications. But, you know, I still think most of what we do is going to go back to normal.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating, isn't it? And as you say, we will undoubtedly be wrong. We'll just probably be wrong in the ways that we anticipate. Just to
definitely be right on.
Well, you know, I mean, just to close on Neil. I mean, what are you working on now? You know, you have a really active kind of research agenda on different issues. Lots of collaboration with different experts. What are you working on right now?
So we're doing some stuff on populism. So, you know, there's been a resurgence of populism. There's loads more research on populism and no one needs any more research. So what we're doing is we're working to sort of evaluate and sort of almost, I guess, do a What Works Center review of the, you know, systematic type review of the populism literature. And then the other thing which we're suddenly very interested in is youth unemployment. Because actually the next thing I think is going to happen is, you know, if you are graduating from college or university now, you will be entering the labor market and there will be fewer vacancies, and the vacancies which there are going to look very, very different. And we really have had very little time to think about what that might look like and what the sort of policy response might be. So yeah, so I'm working on some of these changing labor market issues.
Both great subjects to have you back on City Talks to talk about them when you've done them. My guest today has been Neil Lear. Neil, thanks very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.